guitars, there ain't a soul around. Turn up the dial, kick back, we're freedom bound. So pack up your bags and throw me the key.
And welcome to episode 10 of Women of the Wagons, where the men aren't the only ones with stories from the wagon trail. I'm Cass Patterson. Women of the Wagons is brought to you by Western Financial Group. Western Financial Group is offering you a chance to win $500. From now until August 31st, when you get a quote for home insurance, you'll be entered to win $500 in the Western Financial Group's Quote to Win contest. Entering the contest is as easy as filling out the home insurance quote at westernfinancialgroup.ca/get-a-quote. I'm excited to bring on today's guest, her name, Amber LaRue. If you don't know Amber, you may know her nickname, Team Pink. She is one of the two female drivers over on the CPCA. Amber started as a rookie last year, and she has a very, very cool story to tell, and I'm excited to sit down and talk to her. So without further ado, let's hit our interview with Amber LaRue.
And we are on the line with Amber LaRue. How are you today, Amber?
I'm good. How about yourself, Cass?
I'm pretty good. I guess let's start off at the beginning of your story. You grew up around the pony races, from what I understand.
Yeah, my dad drove pony trucks for 50 consecutive years. So my whole life, since I was 3 months old, we were on the road racing.
50 years, that's a long time to race.
Yeah, so there's no age out limit running ponies. So he ran until, I do believe, he was late 70s last year. I think his last year was 2016 or 2017 when he drove. So it's very recent, actually.
So what was it like growing up around the pony races and that circuit and atmosphere?
It was very family-based. Like, I can remember playing out, and we would hook up ropes. Like, I remember a lot of the time my belt loops were torn off my jeans. We'd hook halter shanks to them and play, like, little mini races. And even growing up, one of the wives had arranged it between the pony chariots and the pony trucks. They had made little makeshift truck wagons for us kids to pull. So we had something to do, and it kept all of us out of trouble. And we would go in front of the grandstand and do, like, a mini mock truck wagon race. And there was, at times, like, 40 of us doing it. It was crazy when you think about it, but yeah, it kept everybody out of trouble, and it was a big family atmosphere for sure.
Now, did you usually win those races?
Well, I was pretty big as a kid, so I actually never once got to ride in a wagon. I was always a puller. So we had a pretty fast team. We had a couple boys, and yeah, it was a good time.
So what age did you start running the ponies then?
I was 14 when I started running pony chariots, and then I hopped in the wagon box at 16, which was both the youngest age limit that you could at the time.
So for those fans out there who maybe don't know the difference between the chariots and the wagons, do you mind explaining that?
So, and the big difference between pony chuck wagons and big wagons is all our horses had to be measured under a laser. It originally was a bar that they had to, like, stretch out under, but then it moved into a laser. So they had to walk under a laser and have a freeze brand on them that said they were small enough to qualify to be a pony and run on the circuit. The chariot is a little too, like, the last chariot I ran was about 75 pounds. It had two little wheelbarrow tires on it. And over the years, they just kept getting lighter and lighter and lighter out of aluminum or puckboard. And it's just two little wheel chariot, I guess, is the best concept. And you have two horses, and then the pony truck is four horses, and your wagons are only 550 pounds without the driver.
So there's a big difference in weight then between the two.
For sure. I always thought racing wagons was way safer than racing pony chariots. Like, when I was 14 at the time, I was like, oh, okay, you know, I have my nice little broke team. But the more aggressive of horse you put on it, and, like, for myself, it was never a safety issue because I was larger stature and could hold my own and hold those horses back. But a lot of kids at 14, with the size of the horses and how light those chariots are, they have their hands full. Like, it seems like, oh, you know, you have two nice little ponies to go out there, but you're flying. Like, the pony chariot times on the competitive circuits when we race at the same, like last year in Frog Lake, for example, the pony chariot start running the big wagon times by 5 seconds. So that's a lot on a long track, especially because that's a 5/8 track up there.
That's freaking quick.
Yeah, they're flying, like it's insane.
So the control that you have in those chariots, I guess it's a little less than what you have in a wagon, because in a wagon it's just slightly sturdier.
It's sturdier, like it's all upper strength more than anything, and your horses have to be extreme, like in any case everything has to be really well broke. But that was kind of the funny part about chariots, is that's where everyone started their pony chuck wagon horses. So in a sense, your horses that weren't as well broke were going on the chariot. So you had your hands full and you had to be on the ball at all times for sure.
So moving into the pony wagons, what was that experience like, and kind of how do you make the change?
Well, I was always fortunate enough that my dad raced, so it wasn't a crazy transition. I got another set of harness and a wagon, and we had pretty good barn depth. Like at the time, I think we had 20 horses on the go. So I had picked with a barn, and my dad is always, I commend him for it. I see a lot of kids nowadays, and I see how it happens. They're given a lot of horsepower at a young age. And even, I think, last season racing big wagons, I started out with good broke horses that I could rely on 100%. And racing ponies, I'm very thankful that my dad kind of instilled that into me, this like baby step system. You know, you start with good old broke horses and then you start fitting in some more power and some more run. So the transition to run wagons, like the first year I ran pony chucks, my right leader, you hollered his name and he turned when you pulled the line and he came right back at you. Like they were such an honest four little horses that I was very fortunate.
That's awesome. Let's kind of talk about the business side, because I mean, chuck wagon racing in general is a business, but it's probably a little bit of a different business when it came to pony chucks than it comes to thoroughbreds.
Oh, definitely. You work full time, because the unfortunate part of running ponies is you aren't running at the big name shows. So your sponsorship is enough to help you out here and there with feed and chewing and such, but you're expensive going down the road, and you're feeding, well, at the time we were running two wagons and two chariots, we're feeding very similar numbers of horses. And of course, a pony eats a little less than a thoroughbred, but we were going down the road with a semi and liner anyways. So the cost was still very similar to what I had last year racing big wagons. And it was all coming out of our own pocket. So that was hard. Like you worked for everything you had, that's for sure. And we raised a lot of our own horses because of it, because I just couldn't afford to go buy those big, expensive, heavy-hitting horses. We raised our own and broke them, and that's kind of how I got the barn depth that I did.
So how do you train, I guess, there's the idea out there about training thoroughbred horses, but how do you train a pony horse?
Well, it's kind of a double-edged sword. So with the big wagons, for the most part, most of them come off the racetrack. So they've been handled since they're a year and a half, 2 years old, they've had a saddle on them, they've been bridled, they've been sent to the track, they've been used to that conditioning. As with ponies, you don't push them quite as young because they're a lot smaller, and you don't know whether they're for sure going to be able to race forever in your barn until they're 5 years old and get that permanent brand. So you have to put a lot of time into them at home with the breaking and the introducing them to a bit and harness and everything, is with the aspect of bringing a thoroughbred home off the track. I loved it. I had five when I was racing ponies, and you could bring them home and line drive them, and they were like instant took to it for the most part. As with a pony, you put a harness on them and half the time they bronked or tried bucking, laying down just to line drive them, because they were like, what in the world are you doing to me now? Like, you're my buddy yesterday and today we're doing work, what? Like, it's just a totally different mentality of things, and they don't know how to be trained. Like, they're, in a sense, there's still that little bit of pony blood in them, and they don't want to exercise. So
they're stubborn, is what you're telling me.
Oh, definitely.
But I guess on the opposite end of that, when you do get that pony trained and you do build that relationship with them, it's extremely gratifying.
Oh, totally, because you've done, especially the ones you've raised, like, there was a gelding, well, he was a colt at the time, but anyways, he was born on my birthday, and I raced him until he was 11, and we sold him the last, like, the summer that I made my transition in 2018 when I started selling my ponies. And that was hard. Like, I saw him being born in the stall in our barn, and we had broke him and trained him and got him to the races, and he was a really good wheel horse. So letting a horse go like that, that you've been in their life since they were born, that's hard. That was a very trying time when we had to sell some of those horses, because, like I say, they had been in our lives, and this was home since day one for them. It definitely took a lot out of me. The mind concept of, like, what you're going to do is going to be great, but you need to get over this attachment issue kind of thing.
So what are some of, like, your favorite memories from driving the ponies before we get into your thoroughbred career?
So when I first started racing, I wasn't with the whole pink thing. Like, I had pink harness, but my wagon, my first year I drove, when I drove chariots and truck wagons for the first year, my wagon was black and my chariot was black. So no one really picked up on it first that I was a girl. And I can remember, I think I was like 17 or 18. So it was the second or third year of driving. And we went by the grandstand, and I, for some reason, taken my helmet off before I went in front of the grandstand, whether I got, like, mud in my eyes or something. I don't know what had happened. And I remember this little kid saying, "Oh my gosh, Mom, it's a girl." Because a lot of people, you know, in the grandstand you're visiting, they didn't really put that connection together. So I think hearing comments like that, and, you know, the little girls starting to pick up on the fact that, like, wow, there's actually a girl out there competing, that was kind of some of the special memories. But also the horses, like, we still have one of the horses that he's 27 this year. He's the same age as me. And he's a Palomino named Bingo. And I ran him on my rookie chariot and my rookie wagon right lead. And, you know, he's still here and still on pasture this summer. So the horses definitely is a huge part of my memories.
That's awesome. I love the name Bingo. In my head, I'm singing the song right now, just, you know.
Yeah.
So you talked about making the transition. Kind of let's talk about what led up to it. What went into the thought process, and how did you make that transition?
Well, it was always my goal to do it, but there was a lot of skepticism within my own household from my parents, you know, with the whole strength factor and the financial factor and just the transition period. You know, it's a, like, do you really want to do this? Because they knew how the connection I had with those horses, but there was a lot of factors that led into it. The number one thing being is it's something I always wanted to do. And I kind of went through a rough patch in 2017. And when I came out of it, I was like, you know, if you can get out of this slump in your life, you can do this. Like, there wasn't much left. And even now today that I look at and I'm like, no, I can't do that. I don't have that belief anymore, I guess. I'm big on the structure of making plans, making goals, and just the mentality that I'm going to do this. So the hard part about the transition was actually, like, my dad was kind of on the way out of running ponies. So it was kind of the decision factor. If we had two wagons on the go, and I was, the last 2 years I drove both hooks, and I was still racing carts to transition in young horses. So it was a lot, like driving 3 or 4 outfits a day. And with the ponies, there's not a big enough draw span. You know, with the big wagons, there's 9 to 12 heats. And if you're running 2 outfits in the CPCA, for example, you usually put with your first hook in the first 1 to 3 heats, and then your other hooks in the very end. So it's usually the top end guys that are running 2 hooks. But with ponies, they give you enough time to rehook, in quotation marks. So you're scrambling, and it was just me and my dad for the most part. So we were putting in a ton of work, and it was getting to be a lot. So the last year I raced, I went down to 1 outfit. We'd sold most of the horses, and my dad had retired. So we went down the road to semi and liner on wagon outfit, and I had made the decision at that point. I had already owned, I think I had 7 thoroughbred spots that I was making the transition, but it just wasn't feasible anymore for the future of my career as a driver. To keep running ponies, I was going to have to restructure my whole way of traveling. And it wasn't what I wanted to do. Like, the family aspect was kind of going out of it, because all the people that I grew up with running ponies either retired or went big wagons. So I had lost all those connections. So I kind of sat back and was, what am I doing? You know, you're going down the road every weekend and for what? There's not much left to it. So I sold the last few horses I had, and I think I kept three at the time. I still have two at home, and one I gave to a buddy for a broodmare. Yeah, so I started slowly buying horses. I bought a wagon. The big thing was getting sanctioned. My parents didn't really want me to dive head in before they knew I could be sanctioned in terms of buying horses. So I was adamant that I wanted to sanction with my own horses. A lot of guys, they'd borrow the wagon, they'd borrow the harness, they'd borrow the horses. But the style of driving I've always had is very much connection-based. I will never drive a horse or race a horse that I can't get along with on the ground. So I wanted to know the horses that I was going to sanction with. So I had bought a lead team in March with the help of my parents because I wasn't in a good financial state at the time. I had saved up all my pennies at the time to buy another wheel team. And yeah, I sanctioned in Poundmaker and Little Pine in the summer of 2018. And it surprisingly went off without a hitch. And even after the first sanctioning, you go out there all by yourself and you just kind of prove that you can stop in the barrels, do your practice turn, stop, be aware of your outriders, et cetera. And even after my first sanctioning, my parents, I can remember them being like, well, you got the first one down, but you still got one more to go before they're going to let you ride. So there was always this skepticism that for some reason I wasn't going to be able to race because I was a girl.
That's funny. You talked to me a little bit about it last summer, I remember, but
yes.
Do you mind talking about the sanctioning process? Because I don't think people really know about it.
Yeah, and even reading in the rule book, there's a lot, you know, there's outlines for it, but you have to go out on your own. You have to contact the director of the association, and you have to have everything organized on your own accord as a driver. So I had to line up my outriders for the morning of my test. I had to supply the outriding horses for them, and you have to schedule your time. You know, like mine was, I think it was 9 o'clock in the morning, right after the morning track time for everybody. And Little Pine was my first one. So I made arrangements to borrow one of the other drivers' wagons so I didn't have to haul a wagon down. And I hauled all my horses down in my harness. And we hooked. And like I say, you have to do a mock race both times. But the first time, you're all by yourself with your outriders. Just, I think it's kind of a, I know it's a safety thing. So it's to prove that you can handle those horses and everything like that. So my first one went off good without a hitch. And then my second one I scheduled in Poundmaker the following weekend. And I had to drive against another driver. And once again, you have to arrange all your outriding horses, all your track time, set it up and everything. And you have to pay a bit of a fee. I think it's $50 or $75 both times to, so it's not a waste of the association's time kind of thing. So yeah, it's kind of like mock races to prove that you're capable of going out there and controlling and driving and your ability as a driver.
Who did you race against?
For my sanctioning, I raced against Brad McMahon. He had a spare outfit that morning and was good enough to come out. And yeah.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
So you go through the sanctioning process and then you make your rookie season last year. What was the season like? Kind of talk me through that and walk me through it.
It was a crazy roller coaster ride that I took one day at a time. I had no idea, absolutely no idea that it was going to be as big media-wise or attention-wise as it was. Because in my mind, I still had this naive little thing that, you know, this is my little dream. And this is what I've wanted to do my entire life. And I've always been raised, you know, you're just like one of the boys. You know, you get tough and you just go out there and race. So in my mind, that's what it was. You know, this is my dream. Nobody else cares. I'm going to go out there and do my own thing. You know, we're going to make everything pretty and try to be presentable and professional. But leading up to it, there was a lot of, oh, wow, okay. I had no, like, the first day of racing, I was just like, I was relieved to get it over with, as terrible as that sounds, because the amount of cameras and media attention that was there, it was mind blowing. Like I didn't have a clue that it was going to happen, put it that way. I was like, oh yeah, all my people from my hometown are going to show up and we're all going to wear pink and it's going to be like kumbaya and wonderful thing. But there was, yeah, a ton of cameras, and I think it's called a risk, you would know from the media thing, where you, it's like eight different people, or, you know, different media outlets interview you all at the same time. If I'm wrong, Cass.
You mean a scrum?
A scrum. Okay, there you go. That's the word for it. One of the reporters informed me on the terminology of it. She came up to me and asked me, have you ever done a scrum before? And I was like, what? Like, and this is just, like, the horses are just unhooked and turned in the pen. And I was like, what? Because she had came over earlier and visited with me and made me feel warm and fuzzy inside about the whole thing. Because I'm, like, sitting there like this little child, pretty much, like, so unaware of what was happening and the impact it was going to have. And yet she came over after, have you ever done a scrum? I was like, what? No. She's like, well, there's so many other news crews here and we all would like to interview you at the same time. So I think there was eight different media outlets right after the races, and I got dirt in my hair and I'm a complete disaster. So I threw a ball cap on, I think, at the time, and could barely put words together, but it came out all right. But yeah, like, to think that that was going to happen, I had no idea. Like, yeah, there's no words for that sort of thing.
I mean, and then, you should be happy that they did a scrum, because it would have taken you all night otherwise.
Oh, totally. And totally. And, like, looking back, I'm so grateful that I've, like, grown as a person from all of this and opened my eyes to the impact we've had from it. But, yeah, and then, once again, in my naive little mind, looking back on the season, I'm like, okay, if you can get through Battleford after the first battle, all this media attention, it'll go away after Battleford. You know, it will go away. So I prepared myself that I was going to just get through these 3 days, you know, stay clean, get through these 3 days. And then I think it was Monday after Battleford, I had another interview. And it was like either Monday or Tuesday after North Battleford, my phone rang. And it was Mike, who does the CBC Sports little pieces during the Calgary Stampede broadcast. And I was lost for words. That he wanted to come out and film, and Calgary had sent him to come do a little blurb for Stampede. So that was like, oh, maybe this isn't just going to go for after Battleford. So we shot a bit in Hobima and Dewberry, and then it just kept rolling. And I don't think there was, I think the only show that there was in an interview, oh no, Little Pine, I did the radio. So I don't think there was a show last summer where I, like I say, in my naive little mind, I thought it was all going to be over with after Battleford. But every weekend there was media outlets to talk to. And I think I've grown a lot as a person from it, from speaking on the spot and everything. But yeah, it was a lot to take in as a rookie driver for sure.
What was Stampede like? Because you got to come and be a part of that, and you got to come out during the rodeo the one day, and you were on the Chuck Wagon show the one night as an interview. So what was that like?
An unbelievable little part of my dream come true. Like, my biggest goal is to be the first female to race in Calgary one day, and just being there makes you want it so much more. The atmosphere, the energy of the hype of the wagons down there, there's nothing like it. Like, until you've stood on that either tarmac or in a seat in that grandstand, and I was lucky enough to, I've always watched from the bucking chute, but just that energy being in that bowl, I call it, like, you know, in the, where the two grandstands meet when they call that the wagons are coming out on the track, it's just electric. And yeah, it makes me want it so much more. And I'm so thankful for Calgary Stampede Board and everybody for having me and honoring me in the grand entry. It was, yeah, like, dream come true.
That's awesome. Let's walk through your race season. We've talked about the media, we've talked about everything, but at the end of the day, your horses are what got you here. How did your season change over last year from the time you started with your first race to the time that you ended in Lloyd?
I grew a lot as a driver. The biggest thing for me was Outriders, that I had prepared myself with horses that I knew were going to be reliable, but I was very much still treating it like a friend thing rather than a business when I was in the first half of the season when it came to Outriders. And I thought that long-term that would benefit me more. but then it kind of bit me in the butt, you know, shortly in the beginning of the season. And I had a rough night Sunday in Dewberry, and I had to make some very tough decisions on changing my outriders up, because I was working my butt off to stay clean, and unfortunately I was having outrider troubles, which put me in a really bad position in the standings that I had trouble climbing out of. I was fortunate enough to still win Rookie of the Year, but you know, you're putting everything you have into your horses, and your wagon horses are working and your outriding horses are trying to work. And I had to make a tough decision to switch up my outriders going into the second half of the season. And after that, I do believe I just had one late outrider penalty after I made that call as a driver. So I was super thankful I did it. There's this, and I know a lot of other drivers will speak to it as well, because you do become such close knit with all your, it's like a big family. So it's very hard to be like, no, I have to make a different direction with the outrider choices, but I did. So for the second half of the season, I had Basil holding leader, or no, I switched it up, and I had Basil and Tyler and Tegan. And then for the second half, I had Tyler holding leaders and Tegan throwing stove for me up until Lloyd. And then I lost them just because of the way the draw worked out. We were in a good enough position that we moved up a heat. So I ended up having Eric Free hold leaders and Basil for stove for me at Lloyd Finals. But all great guys, got the job done, and that was what I needed, which is to be able to go out there and not have to worry about outriders. And as soon as we made that click, things started to fall together, and I was more comfortable with the horses I was driving. And yeah, things really started to fall together, and the positive aspect that I was really looking forward to this season, because I'd bought new barn depth to go in with those old boys to kind of mesh things together, and was going to start doing some moving. But unfortunately, we'll have to look forward to that next year.
So where do you prefer Basil? Do you prefer him on stove, or do you prefer him on leader?
Oh, it doesn't even matter to me. Basil's never took a penalty for me. I could throw him on one of my wagon horses, and I know we'd get the job done. Basil get along like two peas in a pod. We can kind of get under each other's skin, but that's just like us picking at each other. But I know when I put him out there on any horse that there's no, like, you just know that the job's going to get done with him, and that is a very nice thing to have as a driver.
Yeah. Who were your biggest mentors? I know that you had a lot of guys that were up in the CPCA who you raced with down in Ponies. They moved up, and then you got to come and kind of be with them and rejoin that family that had moved on with you, or without you, but now with you. So who was the people you kind of leaned on the most?
So the CPCA actually has this super cool, I wouldn't call it a program. It's just they have it set that you have to have a mentor, actually. There's a driver that's drove for at least 3 years and in good standing. So I chose Robbie Ethier to be my mentor, because Robbie is, like, my biggest thing as a driver, whoever's riding with me in the wagon, they need to be cool, calm, and collected, because I really feed off of other people. And I think that's why I need to rely on my outriders so much, to just get their job done, because I don't need to be feeding off anybody's nerves. I just want people out there that are getting things done. So I've known Robbie since I was running ponies, and he's just a big, jolly, I don't know how to describe Robbie other than, like, he's a jokester. And I knew that if he was my mentor, if I ever needed anything, or, you know, he assistant drove for me in Battleford. And then after that, I kind of, like, whoever I could get to assistant drive for me, help me out. But no, Robbie was just instrumental in helping me out. And whenever I had questions, he was always there, you know, whether it be for when do I send in my horse papers for the day or things like that. Him and Donna were awesome. And even Delaney helped me out. And, Brad McMahon is another one. Chris Molly, another driver who drove in the Westerns, who's hopefully coming back to the CPCA. He was close to this year as Doug Green. All four of those guys lent me horses throughout the season whenever I needed. Like, I had going into last season two solid outfits that I knew I could rely on and knew I could trust. But at times, you know, we're running a lot of days and such. It's nice to have that little bit of a helping hand to know, like, hey, I need a help out here. And they're like, oh, okay, I got a wheel team that's, you know, a little older, but they'll get the job done for you kind of thing. And I, all those guys were there for me. So I, yeah, can't say enough good things about all of them.
So what I'm hearing is you're going to miss Chris when he comes to the WPCA next year.
Yes, I was very, very sad to hear Chris was making the move. I totally get it for him and his family. I totally understand it. But from my perspective, I'm very sad that the Mollies are moving on. Chris actually broke two of my new horses last fall. And that man is a horseman through and through. Like, he's got nerves of steel, and the way he handles horses, he's a professional, and there's a reason he has done in the short span of time that he has been in the big wagon world, what he has done, even the career he had as a pony driver. The man is a horseman through and through.
I've never seen him without a smile. Never.
Yep. Yep.
He hits the barrel, he's still smiling. I'm like, how do you do this?
Yeah, no, like I say, nerves of steel. I don't know. It's pretty phenomenal. And even what he did with my two horses, when I went to go pick him up, I went down there once to see how they were driving, and I was blown away at like a week. And then when I went to pick him up, we did a drive around the block, and a train was coming through. And here I start sweating. I'm like, oh my gosh, now what? Are we going to go drive them around the block? Like, what's going to happen? Chris is like, oh no, we'll just stop here, you know, far enough away and let the train go by. And I'm like, I'm sitting there blinking because it's a 5-year-old that I had just brought home from Washington. And another one I was having a bit of trouble with at home myself. He's a nice, quiet horse, but was a bit spoiled. So I'm like, oh, great. Okay. You know, like, I trust you that you broke him and everything. But yeah, no, the train went by and we sat there as the train went by. And by the time the train was done going by, both horses had their back leg cocked, like half asleep. And I was like, okay, I guess my horses are broke. Yep.
You're like, okay, I trust you. Sounds good. We're okay.
Yep.
Moving on.
Exactly.
You are really, you're an interesting person for me because you very much have a relationship with your horses, and all drivers do. But there's one horse in particular, we've talked about him before, but you say he's like your person. He's just that horse that you have that connection with, you can lean on, you can trust. And some drivers did not have this relationship with this horse before you got him. So let's talk about Mr. Myers, because he's an adorable horse, but he has a very unique story.
Myers is the most quirky horse I've probably ever owned. And he's probably the most spiteful to top it off. He kicked 3 times last summer, and all 3 times were at, he was trying to tell me something and I wasn't listening. As terrible as that sounds, like, he's not the kind of horse that goes out of his way to hurt anybody, but he's just like, he feeds off of me and then throws it out there that, like, nope, this needs to happen. Like, they need to go vominos. Like, so Myers is, he was originally brought up from Washington from Dave Galloway. And then when Dave sold out, Brad bought him from Dave. And he was just a horse. Like, you know, he could throw decent runs, but he was just always a horse. And it would have been the summer of 2016. When Dave and Brad were kind of traveling together, and I went down there to help hook. One of them texted me, hey, can you come help hook tonight? And that's just that kind of pony family mentality, because I had known both of them from running ponies. I was like, sure, I'll come help hook, you know. I crave wagon racing, so I was like, oh, sure, I'll come over. And at the time, I really wanted to start getting my feet into the big wagon world, so I went over, and here's Myers. Just, like, he's a big black horse with a blaze face, and he's got a face only a mother could love. Like, he does not have a pretty head at all. And he's black. Like, I'm usually a bay. That's my thing. But nope, Myers is black. And he was my buddy. Because at the time when I first started helping them, I couldn't. They had a bunch of grays and a bunch of brown horses. And I couldn't pick anybody else. I could pick Myers out right away. And he was kind of a jerk to everyone else. He wasn't the first one to the fence. But Myers kind of knew I would give him grass on the side. So he would always come hang out by the fence by me. So I kind of met him then in 2016. And then Brad had him for a few years, hardly used them kind of thing, but Myers is always my buddy. I fed him carrots at Brad's, and then actually, like, I hadn't made the decision fully to move yet, and Brad thought he would be a great horse for Preston Faithful to start with, because Myers is, he hardly takes any line, he's just a good, reliable horse. So Brad had sold him to Preston, and I was like, oh no, like, and that was in the spring of the year when I was kind of hoping to make the move that summer and start buying horses. But I was like, okay, well, you missed the boat here on them. And then I went over in Onion Lake. I was just walking by Preston's camp, and I stopped in. I was talking to Keith and Preston about him. And they're like, well, he's for sale if you want him. And I'm like, really? Like, really? How much? And we bartered back and forth a bit. And by the time we left Onion Lake, I bought him. And Myers and Sky are kind of two quirky horses that I picked up from Preston, because when I went to check over Myers that night, he was in the barn, and I went to go see him, and Sky was with him, and Sky would not leave me alone at all. He was nudging me, and I was like, dude, like, I'm trying to look at this horse, like, leave me alone, pal. But he's nudging me and would not let, like, he wanted petted and just would not let me leave him alone. It wasn't probably a couple days later, Preston calls me. Well, would you be interested in two more? I know you're going big now, like, the cat's out of the bag. And I was like, well, what do you got? And I talked to other drivers about the horses, and Sky, they all told me he's very, like, kind of a nice horse, but kind of spiteful. So I was like, oh, I'll take a chance on him. So I bought him and Force. And Sky and Myers, they're not buddies out in the pen, but they stand together in the barn, and they're best of buds. And I was so thankful to have them my rookie year. They both drive with rubber bits and open bridles, like an old chore team. Like, you don't know they're there on the wheel, and they're so honest. They're lazy. Every other driver that gets in the wagon to assistant drive with me, they literally turn back in the wagon. So it's, why are you taking so much line on my face? Because I just let them do their thing, and you don't even know they're there. They are, like, worth their weight in gold when you're breaking a new lead team or starting out as a driver. They are amazing.
That's hilarious. So what you're saying is that they in a sense fit into Dayton's definition of a trouble horse that you just fall in love with.
Yeah. I don't know what it is about it. I have a lot of horses in my barn that other drivers were like, nope, don't like them, get them out of here kind of thing. I had bought, and like I said before, I will not drive a horse I can't get along with on the ground. And I had picked up a big black horse that summer. I was buying horses. Like, you know, when you first start out, you have to be very cautious because a lot of guys are just trying to get rid of horses. But I was thankful that Preston was very honest with me on what he was selling me. And I ended up getting four from him, and every one of them worked out. They were just good, honest horses that had been sold to him, but they weren't the caliber of horse like he wanted, I guess, you know, speed-wise or aggression. So I love all four of them. And I had actually bought another horse that I knew he was a handful, but I bought him because he was this big black horse. I was like, oh, he's so pretty. So, and they had tried him for me and everything, and I was adamant that I was going to buy him. So I bought him, and he was an absolute pig in the barn when I got him home. He did not respect me at all. And I kept him all winter thinking, you know, every day we'll get a little closer every day. And not a chance. That horse, like, he wouldn't even get over in a stall for me. He'd look at me like, what? What do you want, woman? I couldn't do it anymore. So one day, Sonny Putcher came in the barn visiting that spring, and he's like, oh, wow, what's that horse? And I told him what he was, and I was like, he needs to go somewhere. I was like, he needs to leave. Like, that's what that is. And he's like, oh, okay, well, I'm helping out over at Jamie Labicane's. I'll see what Jamie's got on the training block. Sounds good. So that night, Sonny calls me. He's got a little horse, and he's a first-year horse, but he's quiet, so quiet. I was like, that sounds like exactly what I need, Sonny. So I went over and looked at him. And I remember the first thing I said, I was like, oh, my gosh, he's a running pony. Because in Jamie's barn, he was a little horse. He was so little. But I called him Little Thief. His name was Clued or Claude or something. But I was like, no, Little Thief. It makes him sound tough or something. I don't know. But he was probably one of the best trades I've ever made. He did not take a wrong step since I brought him home. I ran him on right wheel all last summer, and I'm hoping to move him to the lead this year. So, or next year, I guess now. So, yeah, it's just funny how one horse, it's not that they're being a bad horse. They just don't click. And if a horse doesn't click, they might as well be in somebody else's barn for me anyway. So
it's like a hockey team. When you have a defenseman doesn't fit in the lineup, it's not that you don't like them as a person, but they got to go to a different team.
Exactly. So everything happens for a reason, and I'm super happy I got that little horse. All my barrel racer friends are right in love with him because he's almost as wide as he is tall. But he's just a solid little horse. So
what you're telling me is it's the horse I'm riding when I come out there, right?
Yeah, you probably could. All my barrel racer friends have been trying to convince me, especially this year, that, you know, it'd be a great year to train him on barrels, because I used to barrel race before I started racing, and I'm like, I don't really know. Like, he has so much potential, and up until Lloyd Finals last year, I really was debating whether I was going to let one of them take him as a barrel horse, because he was doing his job, but he just didn't seem to love it. Like, he likes being around, he likes playing, and then I don't know what it was. I ran him Sunday at Lloyd Finals, and he came back to camp and came back and, like, tried going through the fence and terrorizing the other three horses he was in his little pen with, and was pretty much like, I'm a wagon horse now. I don't know if you know this, but I'm a wagon horse. I went in front of that big grandstand, didn't do anything wrong. I'm a wagon horse. And ever since, he's come home and same attitude. So I'm really looking forward to putting him on the lead of the wagon, because that's where he needs to go.
That's hysterical. Before I get into your sponsorship, because you're very good with that, you touched on it a little bit, and we've talked about it before, but mental health for you is a very important aspect to racing and also just to your life. So do you mind talking about that a little bit?
For sure. So mental health to me, like, racing wagons, even though I am so big on being physically in shape to drive, racing wagons with the bond I have with my horses, it's 80% mental and 20% physical. And mental health has been something that I've struggled with my entire life. I didn't fully understand the spectrum of it growing up. I was bullied pretty bad in high school because I was the weird horse kid who would rather be at home in the barn. And that was pretty hard for a lot of kids to understand, I guess, because that was just all I knew, right? My horses were my comfort zone, I guess. And I got along better with them than I did with most people when I was younger. So I was bullied quite badly for it. I was the awkward kid who come from a split-up family and moved to a new town when I was 13. And I paid for it dearly, and I was outspoken. I've always been a talker, and I never would back down. And there was fights, cops called, my car trashed, my grade 12 year. But there was always this end date to high school, and I was like, okay, if I can get through this and I can just deal with it, I'll be fine. You know, I'm going to go off to college, and I'm going to an ag school, and there's going to be other kids with horse interest. And it totally was. I got through high school, and it was like it all went away because I went to college and I had this big friend group and got into partying a bit. And I never realized it at the time, but I had never dealt with my mental health. I had never talked about it. It was just something that was swept under the rug. I had hid it from my parents that I was having trouble mentally. It was just something I was extremely ashamed of, I guess would be the best way to describe it. And like I say, I went to college. I got out of college, got my dream job working at the vet clinic in Turtleford here locally, got to move home, be with my horses, and keep racing. In the meantime, I was masking it pretty bad with drinking, and I was dealing with injuries. I had fractured my hand halfway through one season and was taking painkillers and just masking it all, I guess, was the best way. I was living free and easy. But, you know, I managed to sober up a bit and kept pushing forward at my job. And then at 3.5 years in at my job, well, I guess backtrack a little bit, in 2014, my best friend at the time had passed away in a car accident, just spur of the moment, just boom, gone. And we were best friends growing up. Our dads were good friends. Like, we're still really good friends with his family to this day. Grew up racing together around the track, had goals and dreams that coincided with each other. And yeah, he was gone in a car accident in a heartbeat. And it happened on a Saturday. I went back to work on the Monday. I took one day off at a funeral, and I never dealt with it at all. And I didn't realize it. You know, I was like, well, I got a race season. It happened on the 10th of May, and that's right before race season. So I did what I knew best, and that was train horses and race. And I kept doing that. And at times it would catch up to me, but, you know, I could mask it very well. I was like, oh, just keep racing, just keep pushing forward. There's always this, you know, you got something to look forward to, spend some time with your horses. And then finally it all kind of hit me in the fall of 2016, going into the spring of 2017. The vet clinic I was working at was sold and changed hands. And it was just like high school all over again, with the pettiness and the poking and the lies. And I had no idea who I was anymore. My goals and dreams were completely in the gutter. And I had now, looking back on what would probably be classified as a mental breakdown. I tried taking my own life 5 times in the year of 2016, 2017, in that span. And I was so ashamed, you know, when I left that job, because I left on mental health leave. And I didn't tell most people about it. I told most people I had quit because I was, like, so embarrassed. Like, who does that, right? Like, in I live in a very rural community, and that's not something that's talked about. And it's a large part of the reason why I public speak now about it, and I'm trying to get my story out there to young people, because I still believe nowadays, even though mental health, there's so many initiatives, whether it's Bell, Let's Talk, it's still this, like, heavy shadow of things we don't talk about. You know, it's unfortunate, because talking about it is a very large part to the solution to the problem, is taking it out from under that sheet, right? So I kind of just went all over the map after that. I got through that race season in 2017. And at that time, after I got through that season, I couldn't have cared less whether I raced again. I had no idea what I was doing with my life. I was just trying to keep pushing one day at a time. And I had taken a job that fall that was not detrimental to me at all. And then I left that job after like 2.5 months. I was like, wow, my parents must be real proud of me. That's all I could think of. I was like, you know, to the community, I've left this like ideally dream job working as a vet tech to go work for this guy. I quit that. And thankfully enough, Dallas Wiley, who does equine massage and chiropractic for my barn to this day, we became very good friends that summer, because she had kind of called me out on, she came to work on horses in my barn. It might've been 2016 actually, in Frog Lake. And I didn't know her from a hole in the ground. She walked, I ran into her at the big wagon camps, and she's like, you know, if you ever got any work? And I was like, well, actually my outfit seems to kind of be going flat on me. And, you know, I put all the time in it and conditioned the same as I had for the past 5 years, but my outfit just was not performing the way they should have been. You know, they were a top 5 outfit with the association I was running with, and I was running about 10th, and I'm like, something's just not right. Like, I think one of my leaders is off. So she came over that night, and she looked over my lead team, and she was like, and didn't do much. And I was like, what the heck? Like, and she's like, where's your wheel team that you're on tonight? She walked down and worked on, like, looked at them. And she literally walked back to me in my barn, and she looked me square in the eye, and she's like, what the heck's going on with you? Because there's nothing wrong with these horses. And I was like, huh, this girl has gonads, first off. To, like, go in somebody's barn and just bluntly be like, you know. But I have so much respect for her today for it, because that was kind of the first person who had kind of called me out that something was going on with my life. And that was back in 2016. You know, I had things that I hadn't dealt with. And at the time, the 4 horses that I was running on my good outfit, they fed off of me immensely. And that was kind of a real eye opener for me, that as a driver, you have to be on your game. Like I say, that's why I say it's 80% mental, because you have to be in the zone and there for your horses kind of thing. Cause they rely on you as much as you rely on them. So get back to 2017. I was talking to Dallas. I told her, like, she knew about all this job crap, and she's like, well, I need someone to drive down to Phoenix with me. If you're interested, it'd be a great opportunity. I was like, oh, I've always wanted to see a big track in the state. So I was all over it. I just quit this job, didn't have 2 cents to rub together, but I was like, yeah, sure, let's go, right? So I hopped in with her, and I was down in the States for wasn't even a day or two, and I got a job offer to go down there and work for the winter at the racetrack. And like I said, I didn't have much to lose at the time, because I had no direction in my life. And I'm very thankful for the trainer at the time that took me under her wing and kind of helped me take one step back. And I met so many people down there, and Deb and Mark Buffalo, who trained, they're from Manitoba. They were down there training, and they were like a second mom and dad to me. And they were so good. I felt like for the first time in a long time, I could talk to them. And I could talk to Rody, who was my boss. And there was another groom in our barn, Leah, and Dallas was there. And I had all these people that I could talk to. And slowly but surely, and Rody gave me this big gray horse to work with. And I thought it was insane because he was a handful. But slowly but surely, I started to find myself again and what I could do with a horse just on the ground, being a groom down there. And I came home and spent a week of being home. My parents helped me buy Maddie and Dreamer, my good lead team. And we just kind of started piecing things together on where I wanted to go with my racing career. And I was so thankful for that opportunity to go down there, because I truly believe that was a huge part of what put my life back on track.
You hear people say that horses can be the best source of therapy. Do you think getting to work with that big gray horse helped you?
Oh, totally. Absolutely. His name was Pappy, and Roger Moore has him now, and I hope he does great things for Roger, because that horse literally saved my life. Like, even when I went down there, you know, the two things that had always stopped me from taking my own life were the fact that what would happen to my horses, but I was already at the point where I had very few left, because, like I said, we had sold out, and there was just a few left. So I was like, okay, well, you know, it is what it is, and that my parents would find me. But when I went down to the States, both those factors weren't in play anymore. So it was a real big eye-opener that, like, wow, nothing's stopping you down here. But at the same token, there were so many things, because I was growing these relationships and these bonds and, like I say, finding myself with horses again. And when Tappy came in our barn, a couple other grooms came up to me and they warned me, because they're like, you know, he's kicked people, he's bit people, he's an aggressive horse. So I was like, you know what, like, I'm going to take this horse on like I've taken on every other horse. Like, clean slate, see how it goes. So... And I did, and every day he became kinder, and yeah, he began winning again, which was huge, and had a good race career up until last year, where now he's, yeah, hopefully going to be a wagon horse one day, which is super exciting.
Thank you for sharing that story. I think it's a very important story to share.
Yeah, it gets easier the more you talk about it, put it that way.
How do you keep your mental health in a good spot as you travel through the wagons and as you travel through the next steps in your career?
It is a daily struggle. I don't want to say struggle. I don't even know what the right word for it is to talk about it nowadays.
Process?
But yeah, it's a process, because when you're on the road and in the spotlight and competing, you have to be on top of your mental health. And for me, it's huge. So I write a lot. Like, a lot of the things I share on social media is generally because I've went through something in my day-to-day life. And I'm like, okay, this is how I process it. This is how I've dealt with it. Now, if I put it into words and put it in writing, I can maybe share and help other people. So that's how I write a lot. That's the gist of it, because it's something I grab my phone, I bring out a note, and I can do it anywhere because I usually have my phone on me. So that's my big thing. And being with my horses is so therapeutic in itself. So that's mental health isn't a huge, huge factor during race season, because I am so busy. Staying busy also really helps me. So yeah, racing is very good for the soul, put it that way.
One of my favorite posts that you ever did was you were sitting in your field and you were reading, and just the horses were walking around you and nudging your book, and they were like, hey, you're not paying attention to us. What the heck?
That was last fall. Yeah. So I have a hill that kind of, it's not much of a hill, but it overlooks where I feed them their oats in the pasture. And yeah, that's my spot to go sit. I feed them their oats and I sit and I watch, and I like watching them, their behaviors out in the field, because you really get to pick up on who's picking on who and who's not, kind of thing. Because generally a horse that's like hating on another horse, they don't generally really want to work with them and drive with them. So you can kind of pick up on those things in the field, like, oh, so-and-so's buddy with them, or so-and-so's standing up for them. Generally they work pretty good together, and it kind of helps me mesh things together with my barn.
That's awesome. All right. I want to talk about the relationship you've built with your sponsors, because you have a very unique branding with Team Pink, but you also have a very strong relationship and a very strong sense of relationship when it comes to your sponsors. And you've started to share that with your weekly posts about your sponsors. Even though you're not racing, you're still giving them credit. So let's talk about that, and kind of how has that come to be, and how did you build those relationships?
It's been a lot. I've been very, very fortunate, but whether it be family or friends, connections, meeting these people. I have a friend, Adina Hardstaff, who does Flowers on the Fly in Lloyd, And she connected me with Laura at Iron Jet, and that built that relationship. She's helped me out with McGowan Accounting, which there'll be a post about them shortly. But Kristen and FDD Gravel, I was fortunate enough to be partnered with at Lloyd Finals. And I didn't really directly ask them why they had bought me that night, but they outright said Craig's mom had told me, you know, we're not buying you because you're a girl. It's a huge part of it, but that's not the sole reason. Out of all the drivers in the association, you have the greatest impact on social media. So we're not only getting bang for our buck on the track, we're getting it off. And that was kind of a huge eye opener for me with sponsorship, to be like, you know, because a lot of the times I feel like I do post a lot on social media, and that was kind of reassurance that what I was doing was a step in the right direction, because I am getting those followers and I am getting that social exposure for my sponsors. And that's so crucial, because the thing about sponsorship is they're helping me go down the road and live my dream. And sponsorship is advertising, hand in hand. That is why people sponsor, is for that exposure and for advertising. It's also to help you out and all that. But at the end of the day, they want that advertising and they want that exposure. So if I can do that off the track as much as I can do on, that's so important for me. And that's a large part of the reason why, you know, everything's so flashy and shiny. And I'm thankful for Iron Jet for that, because they wrapped my truck and my semi and made everything all matchy-matchy, and all the tarps that were made through them, the embellishment on my wagon goes up into the tarp and blends together, and it just looks uniform. And yeah, my sponsors are the reason I get to live my dream, and I'm so thankful for that. So I do whatever I can to get their name out there and advertise for them. So that is why I do what I do for my sponsors, because they are such a crucial part of my life and my everyday.
Now, Iron Jet is a promotions and PR company, am I correct?
Exactly right, yeah.
So how has working with them grown you as someone in marketing?
Oh, they've been so instrumental. So when I first partnered, I met Laura briefly in Lloyd, and she was like, to get you the full package of what we do, I want to come to your farm, I want to see your horses, I want to see your liner, I want to see what we can do for you, and I want to get to know who you are as a person so we can display that. And I sat back and I was like, wow. First off, I was like, this is so cool that this person believes in my dream as much as I do. It was like this warm, fuzzy feeling that she gave me. And Laura and Kate are such business women. Like, they are the definition of, like, women powerhouse business women. Like, they, I don't know how to describe it over the phone fully, but they just exude this energy about them that they are, they walk into the room and you know who they are, put it that way. They're phenomenal women, and I hope to one day radiate like that. But anyways, so Laura comes out, and she likes writing as well. And she just made me feel like anything I wanted to do was doable. And for a lot of the process going big wagons, whether it be for my families, you know, keeping me down to earth and humble about their realism about the situation, that I was going up against something that had never been done before, Laura was kind of the first person that really pushed me, that it was like, no, like, this is going to happen. We're going to help you get there. We're going to make everything look pretty, and it's going to happen, girl. Like, we got you. So Laura came out, she wrote an article, she Iron Jet sent it out to every publication that they could. A huge part of what they did too last fall is they did a press release. So they sent out, she wrote her article, and they sent it out to every major news outlet in Western Canada. So the exposure that kind of got the wheel turning from that for sponsorship was huge. And I think every new driver should hire a marketing team. Like, it benefited me sponsorship-wise so much, because people knew who I was before I walked through the door. You know, it's extremely hard to try to sell yourself when you're trying to talk to someone who has no idea what you are or what you do, as where what Iron Jet did for me is they sent it out to everybody. Okay, here's who this girl is. This is where she's from. This is what she's doing. This is her dream. Do you want to be part of it, kind of thing? And that was crucial, because it kind of started to spiral on social media with followers and such. And yeah, they know what they're doing, those girls.
And from there, you like you said, you've built these new relationships with new sponsors, and your social media is awesome. I will give you that. You're very
thank you very much.
At that. So if you were to have a new driver come into the sport and kind of look at maybe some tips on how to promote themselves, how to, you know, get into a sport, because it's not cheap. It's not a hobby. It
No.
is a full-time job. So what would be some guidance that you'd give them?
First off, horse selection. Buy from people you can trust. And don't buy for speed. Buy for easy keepers that have a head on their shoulders. That is the most crucial thing, because a good horse at the end of the day will make you look good. If you go buy, and the thing is, when you're a new driver starting out, you don't have a huge budget. So you're not going to go buy this heavy hitting caliber horse. And I'm not saying that those good brawny horses that guys are winning day money with don't have brains, but those horses cost a lot of money. As where if you pick up a horse that's at 10 to 12 years old, they still have a lot of run left in them. They, for the most part, have a brain on their shoulders. And people, if you go in and they're like, hey, do you have anything in that spectrum with a reasonable price range? They're either going to say yes or no. And be very selective with the buying. Like I say, hire a marketing manager to help you, especially if you're going to a pro circuit. Like I say, Iron Jet was so instrumental of just raising the level of professionalism as I had, because I had never done the media exposure. You know, I had the odd interview in a news article running ponies, but I never, ever had cameras in my face or done anything. Like, we did a mini doc last spring. That was crazy. Leah Hennell came up from the Globe and Mail in Calgary, and they did a mini documentary during spring training and leading up to the first show. So I had no idea what to expect from that. And, you know, having the sponsors and, like I say, the marketing team that you can trust, and everything has to be pretty and presentable. You know, as much as at the end of the day that you think it doesn't matter and you're like, oh, I'll just make sure my horses look good. I was very naive in that aspect. I was like, as long as my horses look good, my wagon and my harness, that's all everyone sees. But that's so wrong. And that was a huge thing that Iron Jet pointed out to me. They're like, no, we're wrapping your truck, we're wrapping your semi, we're making everything uniform and look pretty at all times, because that is who you are and that is your brand. They were really big on instilling the whole branding. And I think as a new driver, that's huge coming in too, because you have to set the tone of who you are to represent yourself to get future sponsors. So, yeah, that's the huge part.
So how did the branding of Team Pink come to be?
Well, originally it was Pink Wagons. That was originally what we had started with, and that was the name of the website. And then, I don't know, the more the season went on, it was like, oh, well, we're kind of doing a team. And it started... There's actually between me, myself, Chloe, and Buddy Grant on Instagram, we have a group called Team Pink. It's just a group chat on Instagram, because one of us, I think Buddy, didn't have an iPhone, so it was just easier if we did it on Instagram to have a group chat about spring training that year. And yeah, it just kind of got turned Team Pink, and ever since it rolled from there, and anybody who was part of it, whether it be a sponsor, a friend, family that helped out, we've all kind of instilled the Team Pink thing, and it just kind of stuck.
Last year you did a really cool, thing that you gave away, which was earrings.
Yeah.
How did you think of that?
Well, I wanted something unique and different, and thankfully I got paired with Newborn Feathers out of Saskatoon. They were a Saskatchewan-based company, and I always loved their earrings. I had ordered from them for a while. And they're a relatively inexpensive earring, but they're super pretty. They're like geode earrings. They're super shiny in the sun, and I just love them. So I was like, you know what? You have to knock on a lot of doors, and you get told no a lot. But I emailed and called them and was like, hey, this is who I am. This is what I'm doing. I don't know if you've heard of it, but I'm going to be the first girl to race professionally in the Canadian Professional Truck Wagon Association. And I know from being around the wagons, there's always lots of kids that come back to camp. I think it would be super cool if I could give them earrings. And they were like, wow, cool. This is super great exposure for us. Sure. We're on board. So I drove down to Saskatoon, met with them, and we partnered up. And there's a ton of little girls all over the country that came back to camp that got pink geode earrings last year.
They're awesome. I saw them. They were extremely cute. I think that's kind of it that I wanted to touch on. Is there anything that you wanted to touch on that we didn't talk about?
Not that I can think of, Cass. I think we covered a lot.
Perfect. Well, thank you so much for joining us on Women of the Wagons.
And not a problem, Cass. Thanks for having me.
I will wish you the best for the rest of the summer and the best for training for the 2021 season.
Thank you very much.
Hi, I'm world professional chuck wagon driver Kurt Benzmiller. The hours of hard work and sweat it takes to be a champion can put your body to the test. Sometimes you win, sometimes you lose, and sometimes you just need a chiropractor. Did you know that your chiropractor is specifically trained to help everything from neck strains to back adjustments to a foot sprain? Don't let pain get in the way of your goal towards the championship. Visit albertachiro.com for more information.
Thank you, Amber, for joining me on Women of the Wagons. Women of the Wagons, where the men aren't the only ones with stories from the wagon trail. That was a really interesting interview. Thank you, Amber, for being so open, so candid, so raw. It was great to have those conversations. They're important conversations to have. Mental health is something near and dear to my heart. So I thank you for opening up about that. And it's also cool to hear more about the pony wagon and pony chariot side, as a lot of guys come up from there. There's a lot of guys who are driving the chuck wagons now who came from those different pony wagon and pony chariot associations. Vern Nolan, Chris Molly, those are just two that come to my head right away. Gary Gorst, and then of course last week I talked to May Gorst. There are many people who have been a part of that world who are now a part of the WPCA and CPCA world as well. If you're looking for more chuck wagon content, make sure to check out After the Ninth with Dayton Sutherland and myself. We will have new content coming your way here soon, and also Outside the Wagon, the WPCA's Backstage Pass to All Things WPCA, that's hosted by Brian Hebson. You can follow us on all social media platforms at After the Ninth, Instagram and Twitter, and then at After the Ninth or After the Ninth on Facebook. Go head over to our website for all things podcast, afterthenineth.com. And for all things WPCA related, go check out WPCA.com. And that is it for this week. This episode, of course, brought to you by Western Financial Group. Get a home insurance quote from Western Financial Group for your chance to win $500 at Western Financial Group. They understand your home is more than an investment. It's a place you share with your family, the place you make cherished memories. As a WPCA fan or follower, they want to help you create memories at home while providing you with the insurance coverage that you need. Visit westernfinancialgroup.ca/get-a-quote or by contacting your local Western Financial Group broker. And until next week, where I'm excited to bring you our Calgary Stampede edition of Women of the Wagons. Not actually, you know, Calgary, COVID, all that stuff. But you know what? We are going to celebrate anyways. So stay tuned till then. You pack up your bags and throw me the keys.